which was really nice. And I had never had a music lesson, a private music lesson my whole life at that point. You know what I mean? It was only at that in college that I actually started taking privates and stuff. I didn't have access to that. But then one day before school, he's like, Mark, what are you doing here? And I said, and I probably took a minute to figure out what he's talking about, but I was like, getting a degree? And he goes, screw that. Man, by the time these kids graduate, they'll have a degree. You'll have an A. I want you to quit today. I will give you an A in every class. Not every teacher is going to do that. But you just need to go. And he goes, spend time with masters. And I remember he said, I don't care if they're blacksmiths, tennis players, or saxophonists. Go just spend time with masters and come back and show me your art. I can't wait to see it, you know.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. This podcast strives to inspire you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. Mark Groudon is a brilliant, curious, and expressive American multifaceted musician. He's a multi-instrumentalist, composer, singer, music educator, conductor, and visual artist. In this episode, we focus on his large and varied instrument collection, and he demonstrates several unusual instruments, including different jaw harps, bicycle handlebars, and overtone flutes. He shares his unique journey and how he developed new skills in response to different challenges and opportunities. I was fascinated to hear about his inspiring recent trip to Kyrgyzstan, about many of his mentors and collaborators, and his expressive approach to musicianship training. Mark has devoted his life to making music for other people and to helping other people make music for themselves. And he is an advocate for openness about respect and understanding for people with neurodivergence and mood disorders. Mark is the founder and artistic director of the Calling All Choir, the Chromatic Community Music Center, San Francisco Sing Fest, and the San Francisco Jaw Harp Choir. He's released several critically acclaimed albums and has toured the U.S. extensively. He's composed original musical scores for dozens of dance and theater companies and scored several films. We are featuring music from three of his albums during this episode, and you'll find his discography linked in the show notes. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on all the podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. The podcast theme music was commissioned from composer Nick Gold, and you can use the timestamps to navigate the episode. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. You can support this independent podcast through both the unique collection of merchandise with a unique and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly, as well as through my Ko-fi page. This weekly podcast is in season 4, and I send out an email newsletter where you can get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Have a look at the description of this episode where you'll find all the links. Now to Mark Groudon.
Okay. Hi.
Hi, Mark.
My camera's here.
Thanks so much for joining me here today.
My pleasure.
When you had reached out to me and we made this connection, I think you were either going to Kyrgyzstan or you were there.
I don't know. I don't remember exactly. But yeah, I was there just recently recording and playing concerts and what have you. Yeah.
It definitely caught my attention, and these gorgeous mm-hmm. pictures and the beautiful jaw harp music. And you appeared on their national TV as well.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Yeah, that was quite something. Yeah. Yeah. By the time I left, there were people like, I'm like, ah, you know, like some people, I guess, started recognizing me. I got lots of marriage proposals. I guess it's totally common for a woman to walk up to a man and make a marriage proposal, you know.
Because you're American?
I think because I'm American and I'm tall, and maybe they knew I was a musician or something. I don't know. But it was interesting, like probably 30 proposals. I think most tall white guys could probably get that there.
So you speak some Russian?
I'm learning Russian. Yeah, it's coming along.
And they,
I mean, I work hard at it. Yeah. I do work hard at it, but only recently. So I'm, you know, very much a beginner.
And over there, they also speak some Turkic languages, I believe.
Well, in Kyrgyz. They speak Kyrgyz, which is a whole other. I know a couple words. Ketik, which means let's go. What was thank you? Rahmat. Those are the two words I know.
So did you have a translator or a friend with you the whole time?
Oh, yeah, I was with, so the project is my friend Irina Bogatyrova. She is an author and musician over there and a scholar on the Vargan, as they call it, the jaw harp, we call it, or Jew's harp or mouth harp. And even though it has nothing to do with Judaica, she was there with me. We went there thinking we were recording a duo album, but when we got But helping us set it all up was Kutman Sultanbekov, who's the I wouldn't say he's the king of musicians. Their status thing is very real, though. He's not the king of musicians. He's the prince. You know, the master of masters is, I don't think he gets out much. But his two main students are, Kutman's one of them. And like for the national, they did this huge national thing in the National Square. And which I love there. It's not a government building. It's a museum. Yes. You know, and they respect music is so highly regarded there. It's amazing. Sometimes I get teary when I cry, talk about music. I can't help it. It's my nature. You know, I'm neurodivergent and I love music. So it happens. Anyhow, he led, 2,000 kids playing right there in the square. Beautiful. And just amazing. And the culture respects music so highly. And
if I could just I want to ask about these 2,000 children. Were they singing? What was going on with that?
They were playing jaw harp and komus.
Okay.
With the string instrument. But they're really into, they do all this flashy stuff, you know. So they were playing those two instruments. So one is the temir komus, the metal. I can show you one. This is made by their master maker in Kyrgyzstan, Bucket. He made this for me. I got to go to his house. Oh my God. Anyhow, I'm jumping around a bit, but he made a huge meal. It was amazing. Like spread out all these different layers. It was like a beautiful 3D art piece because he really worked with layers on the table and all these trays and so many items and beautiful. But okay, so for translation, my friend Arena. Oh yeah, we got there and we realized we can't record just a duo album. We're here with Kutman, who's one of the best players in the world. And then there was another visitor from Yakutia. Are you familiar with it? Doesn't really matter. Yakutia Sakha is a republic in the far, far northeast of Russia. Well, it's not really Russia. They're occupied. They've been occupied by Russia for a long time. But it's over the Bering Strait. And a great player from there. And so the four of us were there. And we realized while we're there, maybe we're not a duo, but a collective that's run by this duo, that just to help people make melodic jaw harp music all over the world. And we do play a specific style, which is a technique, I should say, that's used in a lot of styles, which is we play melodically by opening and closing the glottis. It's unfamiliar with overtone flutes, but it works on the same principles as that. And it's hard. It's actually quite difficult and not very common in the Western Hemisphere. But so she speaks English very well. So she was the one holding it all together. We had four people in the same room, each with their own independent language.
Okay.
That we did have the crossover, which was Russian, which I barely spoke at the time. So, but it was really, it was cross-cultural work is no joke. It's different expectations, different, expressing certain feelings, like it's like, oh, that's really not something you talk about in your culture. Things like that would come up for, and vice versa for all of us. But it was a beautiful experience.
I'm sure you're going to show us a bit of jaw harp music.
If you like, yeah.
But I was curious about the technique, the glottal thing. Is that related to overtone singing?
No. Well, okay. Yeah, it is. Here's the thing. With overtone singing, you always have to be moving air, right? And you can only access one overtone series. While it's the same with trumpet, or say bugle, or alpenhorn, you can only access the one overtone series because you can't, I'll show you what I mean. The easiest way to show this is with, do you want to see
yes,
some of this?
Of course.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I have numerous overtone flutes here. You can see a few there. There's a bunch of them. But the most compelling one, probably, I'll grab it now. Bicycle handlebars.
Yeah.
They work well, and they show. It's a nice way to show because it's makes it real down to earth. But so the thing with overtone singing, you only get this one series. Etc. I could really hone it in, but you get the idea. Now with an overtone flute, you cover one end, and you may know this, but when you have a cylinder that's closed on one end, like a clarinet, right? It can only play the odd overtones. It doesn't play the even ones, right? So you end up, and also you end up with a new fundamental, an octave lower, because the air has to travel, the air has to travel twice as far. Now I can't play that fundamental. I think it's pretty impossible. I did find one way with the fibble flute to do it, but I don't think I can do it here, but it's way down there, a whole octave lower. But what you do, here's the, here, so I get my camera right. Here's the first overtone series with it open. See, there's an octave. Etc. Now, when you close it, you get, it's as if you're compressing the next octave that has eight notes into, you know, into, you can access higher overtones, so to speak, earlier. So here we go. That's the four note octave. Do, mi, so, te, do. If you're using solfege, right? This type of solfege. Now here's what I call, I'm coining lots of terms to describe the overtone series in practical ways for people who actually play with them. Everyone plays with them. They're in every note we play, unless you're playing a sine wave. But we aren't necessarily using those pitches, right? Unless we're playing just intonation. Mm-hmm. Which, do you do much with string quartets?
I have, but...
You have, yeah. But with these instruments, that's all you got. You can't play equal tip per minute if you wanted to. So here's the eight note octave. It's going to be really hard to get on there. I can do it on another foot there. But you get the idea. It gets really high up there. But it's like, you know, in the acoustic scale, do you use that term?
Okay.
We use it to describe do, re, mi, fi, sol, la, te, do. But there's a T in there, and I'm always saying to people, hey, there's got to be eight notes. It's the overtone series. You can't have seven notes in an octave. You got to have eight. It always doubles. Anyhow, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that's a little geeky aside.
So, Mark, if we could just specify for the people who can't see that there's no there's no holes. It's just...
Yeah, there's no holes in the flute. It's just... This one has a fipple on the end, which is the device you see in a recorder, which, of course, if you blow harder, you're going to get sharp, so it has its downsides. And I'm opening and closing the end. So here's open, closed, open, open, closed. So I'm using my palm there and wavering my hand. I don't know how to put it, shake my hand, and I'm getting that really fast vibrato. You know, there's a lot of techniques you can do, extended techniques and stuff.
And that particular flute you're holding now, where is it from?
This is from Norway, Seljaflute. The maker unfortunately passed away recently. I noticed a lot of builders are passing away, but this one, it's really nice. This flute, and historically, you can build it out of willow. There's a little period, say February. It's around February, March, depends on the year, where there's enough sap that the sap is in the actual bark of the willow, but there are no buds yet. So there's this like week-long span where you can harvest it, and then you play it, and it stops playing in like 4 days because it cracks. Talk about ephemeral.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This instrument, historically, and the tone... It's very ephemeral. But of course, this is made out of PVC, right? Later on. And then, of course, they would split wood and hollow it later on. But originally, so Seljaflöjta, sallow flute, I think is how it.
So I do want to ask, I know you play different Nordic instruments, but we were talking about the jaw harp. So if we could get back to that.
Which is also Nordic.
Well, I was curious about the origins because I know it's played in Africa, like all over.
You see it some in Africa. More likely in Africa, you're going to see a mouth bow.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. Yeah. It's not the same.
And most places, like in North America, it's a mouth bow. You don't see jaw harp. Well, you do now. It's different, you know. But with traditional cultures, indigenous cultures. Now, I'm not an expert on this. But I do hear a lot of stories. And the oldest ones, to the best of my knowledge, the oldest ones we found are in China. They found one that's like from 400 BC something. Is quite old, and then they've got then from Norway.
Okay.
Right, but see now Kyrgyzstan. See, it's not a I'm going to hold my tongue because I've heard a lot of different conflicting stories there. But so you'll hear. And so in Nordic countries, in Norway in particular, when the Christians came through, they literally burned all the fiddles. They burned all the wood instruments were burned, and these survived. And you can still see, go on YouTube, you can see this big room of people, and you hear these boots clomping, and one guy in the corner. But they play the melodic tradition as well. Norway, Sicily, Estonia, Kyrgyzstan, which my understanding is Kyrgyzstan, that came later. Like, it's not traditional, but it's hard to believe that once I'm there.
Yeah.
Because it's the national instrument, and they're so into it, you know? Anyhow.
Could you play something on it?
Like, yeah, I'll play you. Yeah, I'll play you an original tune. This is one that I wrote with Irina Bogacheriova. It's called, well, it's really written for her son, Matvey. It can help to deduce the solfege. So, so, do, 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 so, mi, do, 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 so, mi, re, re, do, 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 so, mi, re, re, do, mi, re, mi, re, mi, re, mi. Yeah, do, right? Ba, da, da, ba, ya. Ba, ba, da, ba, da, da. It can help this. See, a lot of listeners aren't used to hearing a melody with jar harp. And so it can help to sing. You understand what I'm saying? It helps bring it out. So do, re, mi, fi, so, fi, mi, re, do. Do, ti, te, la, so, fi, mi, re, do.
So you used to have a jaw harp choir in San Francisco?
Yeah, before COVID. We had a jaw harp choir and a full-on vocal chorus.
We'll get into that later,
well. Yeah, sure. But I had a jaw harp choir. We still meet on our same night. We meet on Tuesdays. It's become an international jaw harp practice group.
Okay.
It's tricky because we're doing the melodic thing, and it's really hard for a lot of people. So what I'm doing there, and I think you may... I alluded to this earlier. I'm opening and closing my vocal folds. We say the glottis, but you can't close it. I mean, the glottis is negative space. It's not actually a thing, right? So I prefer to say we actually close the vocal folds and open them. And that has the same effect as when I cover and uncover the end of the tube. It doubles the length that it has to vibrate to get back out. But you can only access those, the odd overtones.
And what are you doing with your mouth and your fingers generating the vibrations?
Oh, with this?
Yeah.
Okay. So the way to think of a jaw harp is you think of a guitar or a violin, any string instrument, lute or bowed or otherwise. But you only have one string. Now, there are jaw harps with more than one tongue or reed, but let's leave that for now. So imagine a guitar or violin with one string, and the way you change the tone is by moving the shape of the body, that the bridge stays the same,
okay,
right? But you're changing the shape, and you're getting different standing waves or different effects by like, so that would be having a violin that could do a little bit of, and a violin that can articulate, da-da-da, la-la-la. But you don't use the voice hardly ever. I'm not actually engaging the vocal folds. You could.
Yeah.
There's no reason why you can't. But there's different opinions about that. I'm fairly neutral on it. I like to experiment with everything. I spend most of my music time, which is the vast majority of every day, experimenting, trying. I've got all kinds of cool techniques I've come up with recently, you know. But so you're striking, this is like the string. The your teeth are like the bridge and the head nut. And I'm going, you know how you can make a wind sound that's actually in pitch? So with the open notes, do, mi, so, te, for example. It's more pronounced the way I'm doing it now, and I don't have a wind thing. I hope that's okay, the tone. I'm going as I play, mm-hmm. and that's the standing wave in my mouth, and so the instrument will really sing.
Okay.
Right? Now, a little bit of, and actually that little bit of in the back of the throat helps the tone. It makes the air more, it adds to the turmoil in the air, which makes the pitch ring out. It's the same with a lot of inblown flutes. Like, they use a lot of turmoil in the tone, and that's what's happening. And it makes the tone more rich, too. Mm-hmm. It would be like certain types of bowing. When you dig in more, it's going to create a different quality, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of parallels. Anyhow, and I can go on.
Yeah. You know, you demonstrated briefly on the bicycle handlebars, Mark, and I was thinking on your album, St. Judas, you have a bicycle handlebars solo. Maybe we could include part of that.
Oh, sure. Of course. Whatever. Yeah, that's a great idea.
You're about to hear an excerpt from Mark's fantastic improvisation playing bicycle handlebars from his album, St. Judas.
And that's a nice crossover, because I'm not just doing songs like I was for a long time. I mean, even when I was doing songs, touring all the time, I had years of over 250 shows, I'd still open with the handlebars. I'd still break out these wind instruments and be like, get the audience like, oh, we have no idea what's going to happen next. You know what I mean? And it's good for showmanship.
Yeah.
You know?
So let's talk about some of these Nordic instruments, because I believe you play the lure horn and...
Well, the lure I did, but unfortunately, in my move, part of it disappeared.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, spent time in those countries? Like, what was that connection?
I haven't. No, I haven't. I mean, I am a little bit Nordic, my blood, but I've been fascinated with Nordic, but it's way beyond Nordic. It's Baltic, too. It's like, mm-hmm. that's where I've toured and where I've really know much more than Nordic.
Okay.
So Nordic, Baltic, Kyrgyz. I mean, I could just go. It'd probably be easy to just go around and look at instruments.
Sure.
Is that interest to you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, how about if I show you what I've been really getting into?
Awesome.
Okay. So, there's a variety of embouchures that you don't see very much in the West, and I've had the principal flautist for like a big symphony say, "Give that to me," and then 4 days later be like, "How the hell do you do it?" You know. But I've had two of my sons, boom, pick it up instantly. I think because of modeling. They've been around it, you know. So that's it doesn't actually have a name. I started calling it bilabial, inblown, because this is called inblown. And then the other one is
incidental. Let's just specify. Some people can't see.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You're right now playing a bicycle handlebars.
Yeah, these are bicycle handlebars. I have both my lips pursed. I'm not blowing across the top like you would a Coke bottle or a transverse flute, a Bohm system, or what we call silver flute, or what we just unfortunately call flute, because there's thousands of flutes in the world, and I'm a proponent of them all. So there's a lot of flutes that use that embouchure. But a good example of a bilabial flute would be the kaval from Bulgaria or Romania. There's also the kaval with a C, which is, I think it's Chango, which is Hungarian, but living in Romania. Etc. I haven't been working on my tone on this much recently because after about 30 years, I finally figured out the inblown, have you heard of the interdental embouchure?
Nope.
It's, or the tooth embouchure, I know, it's really specific. So the interdental embouchure is you put your teeth on the top, your top teeth, and then you say, shh, through you direct the air with the little canal. Actually, try it. Say shh and see what's actually happening. Do you sing? Are you a singer?
No, I'm a violinist.
So IPA, but yeah. Oh no, I knew you were. Well, that doesn't mean you're not a singer.
Yeah, not a singer.
But you know, IPA. You hear singers talk a lot about IPA, International Phonetic Alphabet, because it's what we how we frame diction. And man, I mean, I just want to say, anyone out there who's a singer, you can improve immensely just by learning some of the basic diction. It'll just make everything, it's how we use the mouth. It's not all tone production. A lot of it's how we use the mouth, and that affects the tone production. Anyhow, I like to mention that because it's accessible and it's concrete. You can see it and experience it, while the tone production is stuff from inside, much more abstract. Anyhow, that's the music educator in me. You are all musicians. You are all singers. I guarantee you. Anyhow, so this is an inblown flute. It's based on, now they play the Nai in Persia is similar. The Chur all through Central Asia is similar. And the Krai from Bashkiristan, which I know, there's all these republics out there. That's one of the best things about learning music from that part of the world. So many cultures that I had never even heard of. So you send the air through shh. When you say shh, it sends the air down that channel in the middle of your tongue. So I'll show you what it does. It always takes me a moment to get it going really well. You can hear my tone wavering because I'm still very much a beginner on it. But this is what I've been focused on.
So before you put that away, Mark, yeah. So it looks like a PVC pipe from here.
Yeah, it's just a PVC pipe. That's all it is.
Just a few holes.
I'm doing all my prototypes on.
Okay.
But it's got five holes. I can show you the next, very similar, is the Chor from Kyrgyzstan. But it doesn't have that fifth hole, right? And they play with this posture because they don't have a fifth hole in the thumb. Mm-hmm. They can keep it against the body, but they stand looking up. And I need to ask Kutman why that is. Actually, I think I did, but then my language, my Russian was terrible. You can hear it's not an equal temperament, right? Which is nice. You know what they say? You know they say the real culprit for smashing out all these dialectic tonalities in tuning systems is the accordion, which I play. But the accordion is set to equal temperament, and it was taken all over, right? And so all these other regional tunings disappeared slowly.
Well,
or quickly.
Let's talk about your start. Like, you're from New Orleans, right?
Oh, I'm not from there, but I did live there. I'm from the mountains in northeastern California. I'm from in the Cascades. I don't know if you're familiar with that mountain range. It runs up from Northern California up into Canada. Northern Cascade National Park. It's an international national park.
Wow.
You know, it's shared by both my country. I don't know if it's my country, but the country that I live in and the country that you live in. Yeah.
Okay. So when you moved to New Orleans, is that when you got into the like blues and playing?
Oh, gosh, no. No, okay, so when I was in high school, when I was a kid, I just played all kinds of instruments, but I didn't have any teachers. I did have a teacher. Starting in fifth grade, I did have a saxophone teacher, and I was playing clarinet, flute. You know, I'm from the mountains where most people have multiple jobs. You can't just have one job. My dad was a teacher, firefighter, construction. I mean, he did and being a generalist is just not a big deal. You know what I mean? It's just what's expected of you. And I was that way with music. I never thought anything of it. I just, okay, well, I'm going to play this one too. I'm going to play this one. I just did it, you know? I was fortunate enough, I won a scholarship. The neighboring county that had in those days a lot more money, actually. A couple of the Soroptimists saw me play somewhere. They said, hey, they got a good kid over in Westwood that could really play. And they gave me a scholarship, and I got to go to a jazz camp in sixth grade. And that meant a lot to me. So, but in college, I was playing blues and stuff like in punk through high school. But I was in a town of, 60 people within nearby town, maybe 900, 23 kids in my graduating class. Yeah. It's a small, and that's three towns combined. It wasn't a big musical culture up there. There was in the neighboring county a little bit more, and they were the ones who looked out for me and got me scholarships and what have you, to camps and what have you. But it was really in college. I mean, I was in a band called Ears for Elephant, and we were really popular in our region, and there was a whole movement of bands. I don't know if you know the bands from that time, like Mr. Bungle or Primus, but it was all these jazz musicians, people, young guys who were training in jazz, who were into circus arts, because I was a juggler and stuff too, but who were writing this music, this kind of circusy and wild, but really notey, Mm-hmm. But some of it, I was really influenced by Stravinsky. I was writing these highly textural pieces. It wasn't notey so much as it was like a quilt, like a tapestry, right? And I was influenced by Steve Reich, and but there was this movement in California at the time. There were four bands that came out of that movement, some that did way better than others. Ours probably was the least known, because a few of us left the group early on. But I think, blues, gosh, I just listening to, I'm big on Muddy Waters and Tom, the whole Chess Records thing. And then, you know what it was too? I was studying Orff Schulwerk, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Yeah. You know Orff Schulwerk?
I mean the Orff method.
Music, well, it's not a method, it's an approach, yeah. With xylophones, and where dancing and singing and playing are not separate, they're all one. That's from Carl Orff going to the World's Fair. But through that, I was studying, most of my students were black. So I had to study, because in Orff, you don't play, really shouldn't be doing the music from the books. Really, the teacher is meant to be arranging the music of those children, or ideally for me, the children you have, their parents do their favorite music. Mm-hmm. Seriously, it really generates excitement, and also the kids are connecting. That's what I would do. So we would do Sly and the Family Stone. We did, we were doing all this music in San Francisco of the parents. Mm-hmm. And I had my teacher, Lauren Pickford, in New Orleans. He always said to me, he goes, well, who do you like? Who do you like? Who are you listening to? Okay, who do they like? Mm-hmm. Who do they like? And no matter what, if it's American music, if it's any kind of, even the slightest tinge of blues or jazz, you can trace that music back to the prison work songs, the ring plays and songs of the Georgia Sea Islands. A lot of it you can trace it back, or a good example would be, I don't know if you know about the fife and drum blues from Mississippi Hill Country. It's one of the two places in the U.S. where enslaved people were allowed to drum, and they still are. It's obviously a different time, but they're still playing. Mm-hmm. The granddaughter's she took the reins, and it's an Otha Turner. Anyhow, so there's certain traditions we can trace it all back to. And that's what I did. I traced it back to, and I just steeped myself in that music. And I will tell you, when I was 23, I was composing music for, I think it was for Joe Good, which is a dance company in San Francisco where I lived for a long time. Someone broke in, stole all of my instruments. I had nothing. So I guess I said, okay, I'm guessing I'm going to sing. And a part of me feels odd about it because of the cultural appropriation. But at that time, I asked myself, what is the most soulful music I've ever heard? Because that's what I value in music. I don't care. I mean, it's what they say in New Orleans about young players who are overdoing it. Like, oh, they know how to play all the notes. As people get older, I don't care about your chops. I care about yours. What are you doing with your music? What are you saying with your music? If you're saying, look at me, am I cool? Please like me, I'm good. I can feel it, and it doesn't do much for me. If I'm on stage and I'm wondering what the audience thinks of me, I am not doing my job. My job is to bring music to these people. They're giving me their most valuable asset, their time. And my job is to give them music. It's not about me. It's not about that. But anyhow, obviously a lot of culture gets caught in that. It's competitive, I understand. And we're all insecure, come on. I get it. And no judgment for me, honestly. But I've been there plenty of times. But I do have a practice. If I start thinking, what are they thinking? I feel my back. I bend my knees. I drop my hips down. I saw stuff I learned from Chinese medicine. I feel my back. I feel the back of my calves. I feel the back of my thighs. And I just sink in, and I give it to the music again. Getting the music. It's not about, it's not Mark. Ooh. I'm not there to impress. I'm there to inspire. That's
no, beautifully expressed. I just, if we could go back to New Orleans, because I was curious, because you spent some time there, and you co-founded the New Orleans Dance Festival.
I was. Have you heard of the Marigny Opera House?
No.
Have you been there to New Orleans?
No, I have not.
It's a Spanish church. Most of the buildings, the vast majority of buildings you're going to see in New Orleans are not French. They are Spanish, because the Spanish were there for 40 years before the Louisiana Purchase,
okay.
Right? And so anyhow, it's a Spanish church built in 1850, so stunning. And they became an art center, and I was their artistic director. And so me and David Hurlburt, the co-founder, and still running that. Actually, you know, I think he retired, but he's still involved, I'm sure. But he and his partner, Scott, bought that building, and they hired me as an artistic director. And I've been artistic director at other venues before, so that was really fun. It was fun to be artistic director of a performing arts center. The challenge was we didn't have all the licensing yet, so we had to be a little sneaky, and then we got caught. We had to shut down for a while, you know. But it was still a really special experience. And you were asking, New Orleans, yeah. But I will say, New Orleans, man, the thing is, you can work there every night as a musician and not have to worry about drawing an audience.
Mm.
The audience at most venues is built in because, truth told, the star is the alcohol most of the time. Sometimes the musician's the star. But even the really killer weeklies like friends of mine had, they're there in service of the alcohol, really. But it's great, though, because they're working 7 nights a week. You don't have to worry about it. There are a handful of venues in town, the Marigny Opera House, Snug Harbor, where if you're talking, if you're like being obnoxious, if you're talking at all, they're just going to walk up to you and go, excuse me, this is a music venue. If you do not stop talking, we will ask you to leave. And I love that, because we need that. We need listening rooms as well as the party places.
Yeah, yeah, so you have a couple of albums. You have an album called In Velvet.
That's with the New Orleans Heavies. I have actually like a dozen, but they're not all out.
Okay.
And I took a job at a fancy music school, and I took a couple of my albums have some fairly blue songs, you know, dirty songs. So I took them off.
Yeah.
I need to put them back up because I'm not there anymore. But yeah. So I have lots of albums. But anyhow, I have lots of albums.
So you were at that time where you had this administrative job. Were you having time to tour?
The administrative job, it was artistic direction.
Okay.
It's not, I wouldn't really call it I guess it is administrative. It was creative.
Yeah.
I mean, but I was not, at that time, I had been touring for years. That was my third album in 3 years. And I needed a break. So I was happy. I had a nice place in New Orleans. I had a good steady job. I was spending my time between New York because I was starting to study at the One Spirit Interfaith Seminary. It was an interfaith seminary for chaplaincy, mm-hmm. right? Which I figure a lot of my music work is kind of chaplaincy. I mean, I'm not religious at all, and I don't have any one tradition that I necessarily hang my hat on, but I do see the value in all of them, and I think it's really valuable to understand that. So I was splitting my time. But yeah, I was taking a break from touring. Oh, man. And have been since. I mean, I'll still, if a venue contacts me and they pay what's a reasonable amount and they're going to bring me out, I'll go do the gig, you know. But I'm not working all the time like I used to. Well, I am working all the time, but not in the same way. Mm-hmm. Being on the road, I'm 54. You know, it gets tiring being on the road like that.
Yeah. And I was curious, I really want to talk about your community choir work. And I saw like a really cool video on YouTube with you doing this exercise, like this.
That's an improv structure I developed. I've developed lots of, I'm really interested in creating formats for a group who's never met before, although that was a choir, the pre-existing choir up on Whidbey Island. I'm interested in creating what we call in theater scores. Do you know that term? Like a score, a loose score. Like, okay, the easiest one is usually, I learned this from Miguel Frasconi. Miguel Frasconi, you're amazing. I love you. he's a composer he's a Canadian composer. The Glass Orchestra was his project. Anyhow, which is start together, end together. That's a great score because you actually end together. And if you don't, you're not done. You know, it's just little simple things like that. But the mba is a little bit more. But I'm glad you saw that. I like that one.
Yeah, and I also came across, like, in terms of your life as a composer, there was, I forget the name of the song, it was a beautiful song, and it was a children's choir in Germany singing a song.
Oh.
It's up on YouTube.
Oh, gosh. I don't know which one.
Yeah.
I mean, the most popular one is called The Rain Song.
That was it.
It has a body. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would call, I guess it's beautiful. It's sweet. It's you know, it's a simple, it's what you, it's a simple part song.
Yeah.
So it's ostinati. Right, the point of that song and another group of songs like that. So I write for community choruses. I also write for high school, you know, college, and professional choirs. But I'm also really interested in writing for community sings, which to me is when a group is together once. And there's no, it's Sunday now. We're not rehearsing for Sunday. It's Sunday. This is it now, and let's get into it. So if I have. There was actually a study in California on senior singers. And it was an inter-UC thing. They had me come and lead the community sings for that, because the key for that was you have to be real flexible. You don't know who you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And I've had groups where no one can keep a tune. So everything I do has to be echo. You know what I mean? Or something real simple structures. Mm-hmm. And I had to dig into my bag, man. I was like, oh, crap, what am I going to do? You know, but fortunately, I've done it enough. But if I get a place where I am there and there is a choir, if I know that I've got a ringer on each part to get people singing polyphony, not homophony, but polyphony, oh, my God, they love it. So I like creating pieces that are concise with, say, four-bar repeating pattern that really speak and can develop, and that you can develop by adding sections or dropping sections, or like there's a B section, say a body percussion thing, you know, in case you're putting it on stage. You don't need that for just rehearsing. And in fact, for a community sing, the body percussion would take too long. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But I want it to be flexible. So I try to, and also I like writing accessible material, but also, you know, I've had commissions. I had a commission for a big marching band, and the piece that came out was too hard, you know, it was. But I was like, for one, I was volunteering because I'm a member of that marching band, so they didn't pay me. So I'm like, well, hey, y'all get what you get. But at the same time, like, no, this piece is its piece, and I have to follow the piece, you know. In that situation, if they had paid me, it would have been different.
What do you play in the marching band?
Oh, alto sax.
Okay.
Yeah, Barry sax, which I have over here, is kind of my main horn. Yeah. I play the cello, some of the cello suites. But I have my horns from, it's so ironic. I mean, I'm not from a family without much money. It's like when I graduated, it was basically a tuna sandwich and like, go get them, kid. You know, I didn't have any, you know, they did try to help here and there. But it was, you know what I mean? I don't have that. I've never had a good horn. You know, my main instrument is over 100 years old. The tone's amazing, but the intonation and ergonomics are hellish. But I still play the Bach cello suites on them because it's fun, you know.
So did you go to college?
Yeah, I went to a few colleges. I went to City College, Fresno City College. They had a jazz studies program, which I had scholarships. I got a scholarship in sixth grade. I was playing at a solo ensemble. I got a scholarship in sixth grade to go to Chico State. The head of the department, he was my guy, and he's like, son, when you graduate, you are welcome here. You've got a full ride. Don't worry about anything. Come here.
Wow.
You know, I know, I was pretty lucky. And then same thing with UNR in Reno, which is the opposite direction, you know, I'm from the mountains in the middle. And they offered me, that was my senior year, they offered me a full scholarship as a timpanist.
Okay.
And my band director was like, you should hear him play saxophone. And he's like, what? I'm sorry, that sounds braggy, but that's the truth. It's the truth. But yeah, I had scholarships, but you know, to both of those, I had to play in the pep band, and they did not have jazz programs. Mm. And I wasn't interested, so I passed them up. So I went to Fresno because they did have a jazz program. My grandma lived there. My grandpa just passed away. But I had some connections there. I lived there in the summers. But also, the teachers they had, man. It just worked out perfectly. My friend, Lauren, who just passed away, he plays alto sax on that album of mine, In Velvet. Now, you'll notice on that album, the alto sax player sounds like he might be drunk. It sounds like, you know, I don't know if you've been to many black churches, but sometimes there's that aunt who's like really going off and probably maybe a little bit high, you know, sometimes, you know, that happens. And That's how he sounds, but it's just because his chops were going. Mm. He's old, but I love his sound. It's like there's something raw and unpretentious about his sound. He doesn't sound like the best him, but it doesn't matter. You know what I'm saying? Anyhow, he was my teacher. He was in Fresno for reasons I can't disclose here, of family stuff. But he was in Fresno, and he took me under his wing. And one, like, he would sub for me. When I was out of town, he'd sub for me in the band he's for Elephant. He'd play saxophone. But he really got me from the very first time. From the very first time I played for him, he was saying, man, you are musical. You are a musical player. He put me right away in the advanced classes, ahead of people who were technically way more advanced than me, but he liked what I was doing musically. He got, you know, which was really nice. And I never had a music lesson, a private music lesson my whole life at that point. You know what I mean? It was only at that in college that I actually started taking privates and stuff. I didn't have access to that. But then one day before school, he's like, Mark, what are you doing here? And I said, and I probably took a minute to figure out what he's talking about, but I was like, getting a degree? And he goes, screw that. Man, by the time these kids graduate, they'll have a degree. You'll have an A. I want you to quit today. I will give you an A in every class. Not every teacher is going to do that. But you just need to go. And he goes, spend time with masters. And I remember he said, I don't care if they're blacksmiths, tennis players, or saxophonists. Go just spend time with masters and come back and show me your art. I can't wait to see it, you know. And so I did. I quit school. And I have bipolar type 2. So I'm like, I was on a manic phase anyhow. Not manic, but hypomanic. We don't get manic anyhow. And I was like, okay, great. I gave away all my possessions, started walking across North America, meeting all these people for a couple of years. Oh, it was an amazing experience.
This is Driving Into the Sunrise for Mark's album In Velvet with the New Orleans Heavies.
Driving into the sunrise. My baby, driving into the sunrise, see my guy. She waiting for me down in New Orleans with a grin on her lips and a kiss in her jeans. Driving into the sunrise, see my guy. There ain't no hurry, there ain't no worry, gonna see my baby today. I'll take her down to the Mississippi River, gonna watch it roll away. Oh, into the sunrise, see my baby. Driving into the sunrise, see my guy. She wait for me down in New Orleans with a grin on her lips and a kiss in her jeans. Driving, oh I'm driving, oh yes I'm driving into the sunrise, see my guy. My baby, the sunrise, see my gal. She wait for me down in New Orleans with a grin on her lips and a kiss in her jeans. I'm driving, oh, I'm driving, oh, yes, I'm driving into the sunrise, see my gal.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. You may also be interested in my episodes with other wide-ranging musicians involved in community music, instrument making, and exploring, such as with Lindsay Pollock, Kavisha Metzella, Philip Griffin, Polina Shepherd, Jesse Stewart, Sarah Jeffrey, and Gary Musinski. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project cost me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support the series through either my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, phone cases, notebooks, water bottles, and more. You'll also find the links to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Please check out my back catalog with weekly episodes going back to 2021. Now back to Mark Groudon.
Yeah.
You mentioned you were you juggled, so were you busking using different skills?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would busk. Yeah, I would busk a lot. In those days, in the 80s, I was playing didgeridoo. I was one of the earlier. It was me, this guy, Stephen Kent, Stuart Dimster from the Deep Listening Ensemble, Norman Rutherford. There was a woman, I forget their names, Tanya and Rob, who got me started. They were in Colorado. But there were very few of us. I mean, like 10, maybe. And it hadn't become the 90s hippie instrument yet. And I'm not trying to diss anyone when I say that, but it did become associated with the 90s hippies. They're very much so. You know, like the Portlandia kind of vibe. You know what I mean? The dream of the 90s. Anyhow, so I'd play didge, I would juggle. Although I didn't juggle, I juggled more. I like passing clubs. And I did it more for the experiential than I did for the performative. I will say that's a lot of my music. I studied with masters from all over the world. But I would only play that music or those instruments on stage if they invited me to play with them. I'm not going to go play bansuri on stage, like Northern Indian classical flute, because I don't feel comfortable. I don't feel comfortable as a white guy doing that. I don't. Never have. When they'd invite, you know, but I was never invited on that instrument. But other instruments, I was invited, then I would go, because I'm there with a master. And they're choosing me. It's very different than me choosing myself. Hey, I'm a representative of Ghana. I don't know, it makes me uncomfortable.
So were you meeting these people in different places in the States, or was it touring more?
Oh, it was all in the States. I didn't have the resources to travel. And then I ended up, you know, my first kid I had when I was 26. So it was a pretty short window. But, that lasted a few years where I traveled. Oh, in college, okay. So I went to, for music, I went to City, studied jazz. Then later on, I went back to school. I studied art. I'm also a painter and a printmaker. And then I went to Holy Names in Oakland, which had, they don't have it anymore, but they had an amazing Kodai program.
Okay.
And that's where I got to study with the Hungarians, who changed my life. You know, what is her last name? Judit. And Ildi. Oh, man. And Michael Calkin. There's a whole lineage, you know, because they've been there for a long time. So there's a lot of teachers around with that. And the way that changed my life, seeing the way, having been taught the American kind of theory way of learning music, where you write it on the board, but you don't actually get it in your body, was very, you know, and it never made sense to me, you know, because no one in that class could just sing you a harmonic minor. Or they might be able to sing you a harmonic minor, but they couldn't do it readily. That's not what we were learning. We were just seeing it, right? Information. And that's theory as information. Yeah, theory is really just terminology. It is. But you gotta ground it. So that's the Hungarians, everything's in your body. Oh, amazing. Amazing stuff. And that changed, thankfully, I had already, well, you know what, part of it is like the thing of that we do a lot in North America of, here comes the bride. Yeah, that's the perfect fourth. But that's the soda dough. That's 5-1. That's not 1-4. And to try to imagine some other song while I'm trying to sightsee something, there's a lot of people of us were taught that way.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but that's whack. It's crazy. It doesn't make any sense. Once you know about function, and then the Hungarians, you listen to the quality of the notes, and you just know where you are. You don't have to measure out a major seventh by adding up minor seconds. You just get it in your body, and bam. It's like having this yardstick that's super accurate and flexible. Boom. You just want a fifth. Boom. Here it is. Instead of it stacking up other intervals, right?
Yeah. So, Mark, you do teach a lot of choral singers. You do these musicianship courses. So how do you teach people to sing intervals then?
Oh, interval. Okay. Well, to sing intervals, they're already singing them. Okay. Yeah. Well, what I do. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. One of the main things I do is focus on function, the feeling of the notes within a diatonic scale to start. Mm-hmm. So say we have, you should be able to hear this. Do you hear that?
Yep.
So let's say C major. So I will say, Re, it's not stable. It wants to go down to Do. It could go up to me, but really wants, for me, my opinion, it feels like it wants to go down to Do. And subjective perspective on this is perfectly fine. Whatever gets you through the night. Is how I see. For me, which is so out of tune, equal temperament drives me nuts, but that's what we got. And I know that some people argue with that, but I promise you, listen to a major, C major triad in just intonation next to a one in equal temperament and go back and forth. Oh my God, equal temperament sounds like a cat fight, comparatively, yeah. Relatively, truly. So here we are. C, me, or the major third, is happy-go-lucky and stable. It doesn't really need to go anywhere. Fa is the note of love to me. It really wants to go down to me, but it's more out of desire and natural gravity more than neurosis, like another note coming soon. So if it's harmonic, it's very stable. If it's a harmonic interval, even here or even here, it's stable. But once you make it a melodic, it wants to go back down to Do or up to Do. Probably not if you're ascending from the bottom, though. Right? Etc. La is like, La is really aloof and kind of just doesn't care. And it's stable in that way that it doesn't, you know. And she reminds me of like someone who's really, really good looking, got a lot of attention when they were a teenager. So disassociating, just kind of floats around being, don't look at me. You know what I'm talking about? Then T. Has T is neurotic. T needs, although T, oh my God, so beautiful. Especially when, if it's not like in a chord, in a seven chord, if it's voiced right and balanced right, not too big, because T can take over the whole thing. But if it's subtle, oh my God, T is so beautiful. That tension, you use it as a composer. And then Do, very stable again, etc. And then I do a lot with singing the tonic, Do, So, Do, locking those in tune, and then I add the third. Do you know the Wedge book, George A. Wedge? It's like over 100 years old. He has these exercises. I always tell my students, do not read the text. It's so archaic, it's going to mess you up. But the exercises, if you do them with a drone, that's one thing too. A lot of people, I see singers practicing like this. Ooh. With their phone. You know what I mean?
In terms of like...
tuning.
Watching the needle or...
Yeah. Okay. Those are for instruments. Those aren't for us.
Yeah.
You tune to something else. You've got to have something else in the environment. A drone or a chord progression or a practice track. I like drones. I realize I'm looking down here a lot because that's where the camera is. Hi, everyone. I'm actually paying attention to you. Anyhow. But to sing with drones, I learned that from the great composer David Conti, who's the head of the composition department at the conservatory in San Francisco. He goes, oh, you need to be doing all of these with the drone all the time. And it's like, oh, duh. You know, once he said that, you know. I have lots of influences from a lot of places, but a million solfege exercises and ear training. You know, it's a whole integrated world. But teaching that and stuff, I do still teach my students the crutches just as a point of reference, mm-hmm. but not until they've got this down.
So how did you get into choral direction?
Yeah. Okay. Remember when I said all my instruments were stolen?
Yeah.
I was not a singer at that point. I was still in the mindset that I have to specialize somewhat and be a this or a that. And that if you haven't done this or that since you were a little kid, you're never going to be good at it. It ain't necessarily so. There aren't very few violinists, saxophonists, clarinetists, instruments like that, oboe, that really take a lot of effort for tone. Flute? No, flute's way easier. Frankly, it is, the tone. I mean, you get a lighthead at first, but it's easier to attain a strong tone. Bowed strings, especially violin, because of the proximity of notes, right? It's hard. It takes a long time to get a really solid tone. Probably not going to be first chair in the symphony. You're not. I mean, it's unlikely, right? But voice is actually, we all have it. It's a different thing. And a lot of singers who do have classical training young end up having as much stuff they have to break down as they have to develop. You know what I mean? I mean, well, depending on their teacher. Some teachers really buy into the, if you are better at this exercise, you are a better person. No, we are all equal of love. We're all equal of respect. I don't care how good you are at sewing, how good you are at music. It doesn't matter. It doesn't make us better. We're not special. We might be more skilled in a department, but that does not make us superior. Power, which is an illusion. The only way they can feel it is by putting other people down. And it doesn't actually substantiate it. It just gives a sense of substantiation, and it feeds the addiction. Anyhow, I'm very much into humanity. But so I lost all my instruments. And then I found an accordion in the basement of the elementary school I was teaching. And the head of the high school where I was teaching music, the head of the theater department heard my plight, and he gave me his grandpa's banjo, which was not a great banjo, but I had a banjo. And I started singing, and I realized, oh my God, anyone can do this. I had a terrible voice, and now that's what's been paying it's my voice, that's the main thing people come out for, you know? I mean, now if I'm in a Jawhar festival, that's different. There are people who think I'm a Jawhar player, don't even know I'm singing. And there's people who, you know what I mean? I have different, really completely different worlds. But it dawned on me is that anyone can do this, and I have to help them because I have the skills. I was already an ORF trained teacher. I already had a bunch of other music education. And I was already teaching high school and middle school. Even though I didn't have a degree, I was teaching, at really good schools in San Francisco. And it's my calling. I have to help people make music. I have to.
And you put out a bluegrass album.
Oh, wait, it's not bluegrass. No. But I understand what you're saying. Well, bluegrass is a specific style. It is not folk music. It is popular music. It's made for the stage. Mm-hmm. Depending on what your criteria is for folk and pop. But it's commercial music made for the stage. The album I made is more Western. It's with all these musicians from Tucson. Because I play banjo,
Yeah.
I play clawhammer. So in Tucson and outside of Tucson, there are all these Western musicians. They don't identify as country. They're not certainly not rhinestone Nashville country. They're more outlaw-y, Western, right? And like my friend Clay, growing up in his family, they'd all like regularly sing songs together from all kinds of traditions. But they'd have an upright bass, a mandolin, a guitar, a banjo. I don't know if they actually had a banjo. And whatever, different instruments, and they'd swap. They just circulate the instruments every time. And, Clay, I'm going to sound like a terrible snob, but there are only really two guitar players I really, really, really like to work with, because a lot of guitar players tend to play a lot of cliches, a lot of, butt rock stuff. And these two guitarists are Miles Boyson from Oakland, who's in Clubfoot Orchestra, plays... he's mastered a lot of and recorded like Cronos Quartet. He's a master in his field, and he reads like nobody's business. I mean, it's not the easiest thing for him, but how many guitar players do you know that read? It's hard to find. And anyhow, this other guy, Clay Coak, and Clay's from the desert outside of Tucson. Anyhow, yeah, so that's that album. It's all recorded. I will say, with those albums, they're all recorded live in the studio. We're all there together. We did put the harmonica player in the other room because his tone,
Are we talking about Lose Me in the Sand?
Lose Me in the Sand, yeah. So and I'll say some of those songs are originals, and some of them are like, well, gosh, I'm doing an album with all these country, these Western musicians. I don't know exactly what to do. So I pulled out some old classics, and, it has its upsides and downsides, but I do really, there's some improvisational elements on that album I really like. Textural, I really like atmospheric. Mm-hmm.
You're about to hear Shady Grove from Mark's album, Lose Me in the Sand.
Two, one, two, three, four.
Shady Grove, my darling. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm gonna beg your pardon. Cheeks as red as the blooming rose, eyes of the deepest brown. You are the darling of my heart, stay till the sun goes down. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, my darling. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm gonna beg your pardon. She was standing by the door, shoes and stockings in her hand, tear falling on the floor. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, my darling. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm gonna beg your pardon. Summertime, apples in the fall. If I can't have my Shady Grove, I don't want no one at all. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, my darling. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm gonna beg your pardon. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, my darling. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm gonna beg your pardon.
And now you live in Portland?
Yeah, unexpectedly. I had just gotten a new place in the Bay Area. I was there 4 months, and the day I moved in, my whole body itched. I didn't know what was going on. By the time I left, I had a rash over almost my entire body. I was losing sensation, and it turns out I had black mold. So I left immediately, and I was in a hotel for a minute there, and then my friends up here, who've been following my work for about 30 years, Jinya and Tia, thank you, Jinya and Tia. They heard my plight and they said, "Hey, we own several properties in the Portland area. We have one that's vacant, and black mold is a real thing up here too. But we went through it ourselves, and we've had the house checked twice. We had it checked once. We'll have it checked again before you come. We're going to get you a U-Haul. Don't worry about it. You pay us back someday. Get your ass up here and, you know, heal." And I did. Oh my gosh, so much better. I mean, it's still, mold is an issue up here, but being in it was a very small space, a tiny house. Oh my God. And that enough was hard enough. I couldn't even turn. I have big shoulders. I turn and like knock things over. You know what I mean? So it's nice to be in my own place, you know. They really saved me there. So yeah, I'm in Portland, and I'm way out in East Portland in a neighborhood called Rockwood. And it's an old, I don't know if you know the history of Oregon, but it was founded as a white utopia. Super racist, yeah. Oh yeah, this is real. This is real. And people of color were not allowed to live in city limits, nor were they allowed there to be in city limits after sundown. Hmm. They call them sundown laws, right? It's a sundown state. So this area where I am was unincorporated, so it's super diverse. I love it. But I'm really far away from the rest of Portland, and it's also regarded, it was just cited as the poorest neighborhood in all of Oregon in the newspaper like a week ago. In fact.
So are you doing community singing up there?
I'm not. I'm looking for a venue, a way to do that. I just started playing shows out. I mainly, you know, I had some really big, challenging gigs this year, producing a thing for the One Archives and Getty Museum. Like, that took months.
What was that project?
It was really cool. It's not done because the exhibition is in October. But there's a woman. Her given name is Edith Ida. Edith Ida, I don't know for sure how to pronounce it. But she was involved in the very beginnings of fandom for sci-fi in the 40s and 30s. Mm-hmm. She went by Tigrina, and she put out a hymn as a zine. It's a hymn to Satan that she put out in 1941 or 40. Oh my God, this was a big deal. And she started the first lesbian periodical in North America. She was a great composer, and she only got to hear this performed once when it was sung in Esperanto. Is that the language?
Esperanto,
yeah. To cover up the meaning of the song, which I think is brilliant. I mean, I don't know that that was her intention, but seems like a fairly likely that she chose to do Esperanto to cover up that the song was for Satan, you know? Yeah. But she identified as a Satanist, but she didn't, as far as we know, didn't actually worship Satan. It was more to, she's just super punk rock in the 40s, you know? She's very counterculture. And, you know, and she was raised by a really restrictive family in the Midwest and came out to San Francisco and, like, just cut loose. Well, there's no recording of this, so I got a call from a scholar in Boston. Actually, I don't know that he's in Boston, in Massachusetts, saying, hey, here's the sheet music, and it's handwritten, really hard to read. The ledger lines were all, you know, a lot of variation in width or height, you could say. You know what I'm saying? So, man, and it's also him to say, and I'm like, did the person who wrote this write this on purpose? So make it so difficult to read on purpose just to make it, you know what I mean? Like to show it, not say it. I don't know. You know what I mean? Right. Yeah. And they approached me, and I didn't really realize what it was when I heard about it. Cause I heard about it from a friend. Then I got it. It's like, cause I heard about it and I booked the big Basilica in San Francisco. Beautiful tone. That's where the choir I directed performed a lot. And where a lot of the great choirs down there record. And I had booked it. I talked to all these musicians in the San Francisco Symphony who are all religious, many of them. A lot of choral singers are religious, right? It's just the nature of the beast. Or not the beast, pardon me. But then I saw the title. I was like, oh, this is not going to work. So I had to cancel everything I planned because I hadn't actually seen the title yet. I just heard about it. This piece by this mid-century. And then I saw it. I was like, oh, okay, we're starting over. But it was hard getting a group of singers together to sing that song. I worked months just hiring and then people backing out once they saw it, you know. But then I found a group of people who were, like, either identified queer, non-binary, and who were science fiction fans, or some of them actually, like, Satanists, who were like, yes, let's do this. Because I don't want to get a bunch of people singing on. I produce a lot of music and a lot of work. And I do not want anyone up there feeling uncomfortable about what they're doing. No way. No way. Especially if they're afraid there's going to be consequences later.
Yeah.
Not a chance. I want people, people got to feel what they're doing. You know, so I finally got the right group. We had a few cancellations on the day, so the parts aren't as full as I would like. But so I did that, and then she also wrote a piece for piano. It was an art song. It's basically a Halloween carol, you could say. And so I know carol is specific to Halloween. It's a Christmas, but you get the idea. And they asked me, the people who hired me to do it, the scholar, they're publishers and scholars, historians, they asked me to add strings. So I added upright bass, because you gotta have bass if you're gonna add anything else. And then I added violin. I would have been fun to do more, but anyhow. But yeah, it was a really fun project. And then then there's the Kyrgyzstan trip, and then I was also in Hungary. This year has been more about outside, and also I had students who had big projects, you know, like some of my more advanced musicianship students who sing with the symphony and stuff had some more demanding projects. So I was focused on that. But now I'm actually focusing on Portland. And fortunately, like the guy who owns almost all the music venues in town, he's one of my best friends. And he's a big fan. So I have carte blanche, which is handy. So I'm just starting to spread out that direction.
Okay.
It's more like I had to pull my roots in for a while. Now I'm starting to spread them here.
And the trip in Hungary, what were you doing there?
I was performing jaw harp at a great festival. It's only one day long, but oh, what a beautiful festival! By Aaron Salagi. He runs Dorom.com, which he and his father are makers. They make great harps in the Hungarian tradition. It's not melodic; it's rhythmic, and they do a lot of back and forth, like this harp's not made for that, but. Yeah, the trigger's too long, but yeah, I don't have a proper harp in front of me, but you get the idea. Yeah. More of a they call it techno now.
Okay.
You know, because it imitates that. But he's a great player, and there are players from mainly Europe. I think I was the one who traveled furthest this year.
So it's a jaw harp festival?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. World Vibes. World Vibes Dorom Fest. Because Dorom is how you say it there.
Okay.
Right. So the word is that this instrument has over 1,000 names. But when I was in Kyrgyzstan and I said that, Kutman looked at me and he said, 2,000 easy. So I'm not going to argue. Let's say, but it has a lot of names around the world, right?
So are there maybe a couple other unusual or favorite instruments you have that you would like to show us?
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think of what's really special that you won't see hardly anywhere else. For one, I'll play a bass jaw harp, because these are hard to find. You can find them in the U.S. There are players, but often there's the whole melodic element. Right, isn't that beautiful?
It is beautiful.
I want to say here, I have a dream, because I used to be John Sherba, the is he second violin or viola? I think he plays viola with Kronos. I was his son's music teacher for a number of years when he was in elementary school. This is like 25 years ago. But John Sherba, I really want to write for the Kronos Quartet. No, but I think it would be great to write like some jaw harp, get these the best players in the world together with Kronos or another quartet too. Mm-hmm. The thing is you'd have to use just intonation, right? Which would be fun. I think it'd be a really fun, challenging project. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really into the inblown flutes these days.
Sure.
Well, the Barry sax, you're going to see Barry sax all the time. You can edit it. I'm going to peek around real quick and see what I have.
Sure.
Is that cool? You know, I have lots of string instruments. But they're not tuned, and they take a while to tune because they're not geared. I'll show you one. Oh, you know what? I think if I were to talk about an instrument, mm-hmm. I'll show you in a second here. That's really out of tune. These though, they're tuned, whole tone.
Oh.
Do re mi fi si. Right. Do re. It's not in tune now. But you know who? Of course, you're probably aware that Debussy is often credited with bringing the whole tone scale to the West. Mm-hmm. And then he claims that he heard Russians using this. They don't use it in Russia. But at that time, Lithuania was part of Russia.
Oh.
And I think that, so there's a style of music called sutartines from, this is something I toured in Lithuania with the two stars of their folkloric music show. This is the most popular show in the country, like on Wednesday nights. And they, that part of the world uses the overtone, the whole tone scale, and their music is secundal, the harmonies. Oh my God.
What do you mean by secundal? Based on seconds?
It's not what what's the word, but it's not based on triads. It's based on seconds.
Yeah.
Oh my God, so beautiful. Listen, if you check out, are you familiar with Veljo Tormis, the Estonian composer? Oh, wow. He has a piece called, well, it's actually really long, but it breaks down as Tabu, T-A-B-U-E, T-A-B-U, which is, you know, taboo, like you shouldn't talk about this. The whole song is a reference to being listened in on by the secret police. Mm. It's taboo, 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 taboo. But it's all seconds, and it's, we did it. We did it with the community choir. We killed it too, but it was hard. It was a lot of hours. You know what I was going to say? One thing that might.
Wait a minute. So it's a type of zither you were holding?
Yeah, yeah. It's a zither or a. A zither typically, I believe, has. It's a type of psaltery. A psaltery, right? It's a Baltic psaltery. It's handmade in Lithuania. You can see the tuners. Those tuners are hard. You got to have this special tool.
Okay.
And then they're, you know, it's just friction. They're just a headache. But I have lots of instruments like that. If you ever want to do another second one, I can tune all that stuff in advance. But, I mean, no pressure. By the way, I'm having such a good time, though.
Good.
I really like, you have a really nice presence. I feel comfortable. Yeah. You know, but I was going to say, the instrument that I've been exploring a lot recently is video. I'm making visual music concrete.
Yeah, I saw a little bit of that. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a new one I'm going to release today, actually. So this one is me playing, not this one. I have another one with like 9 strings, 11. It's meant to have 11, but you take one off. There's this whole tradition they have. So this one is me playing one of those. Remember in May it was the flower moon? I don't know if you caught that. Because it was something special about the moon. Either we had 2 in the month or there was some kind of what it was that made it a flower moon, which was special. Mm-hmm. And so I was just out there. I had finished like some late night thing, and I was out there. Like, I often play psalteries at night because they actually dream of making a bed that has psalteries built into the sideboard and headboard that tune automatically. That will somehow so that people can lay down and go, seriously, because it's a harp. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a harp with a body that's underneath it. I mean, but it's a harp, and there's something so calming about that instrument. Can be. Also, I know people that play it in Russia. They play it like an auto harp, where they cover the strings you don't want to hear, and they strum it. So it's a much more lively sound. That would be a Slavic zither or a Slavic psaltery, actually. But anyhow, so I took this one where just these little moments of me playing, and I made a whole. I mean, it's only a minute and 30 seconds long because I'm going to post it on Instagram, so it sounds funny. But it really is a developed composition. You know, I would call it an opuscule. You know that term?
Nope.
Little works.
Okay.
A little work. So it's an opuscule, but it's a work. It's a real work. There's harmony. I take little elements. I speed up the video. I slow it down at precise amounts to get just intonation. And then to make harmonies with what I'm doing out of these original sounds. I did one you may have seen with, it's just me stepping onto an escalator and getting off. But I have like an 8-minute video. I send out a condensed one that I just take all the sounds from that and develop them and bring them out and use them in harmony. And so it's music concrete, but with video. And most of them are literally just the tiniest little snippet. Another one I did is I'm playing an inblown tooth embouchure or interdental embouchure, and I'm standing on a stairwell and I'm layering it, and you can tell it's the exact same take but sped up, but But I have to do this whole thing where I export it and then bring it back. It's this whole thing to get the clips to be the same length but at different pitches.
Well, for the listeners, first of all, we could edit something in, but if it's highly visual, it'd be better maybe just to put a link in the description.
Yeah, that's great. I would love that. I could do is I could put them all under one. They could go to see the little body of work.
I've got three of them now. A playlist.
Yeah, a little playlist. Yeah, that would be great for me. I mean, you know, because each one, I'm still very much in the very early embryonic stages of this particular craft because I'm not much of a video editor. I'm just learning.
Yeah.
So anyhow, but that's, it's been fascinating for me. I will admit, though, sitting around and playing a flute, you know, is much more fun than sitting at a computer editing. But the craft of that, you know, I really have enjoyed it, and I'm liking what I'm coming up with. Mm-hmm. It feels accessible, like other people could do it easily, too. Anyhow.
You know, I was thinking, I've talked to so many fascinating musicians around the world, and you're in a certain group of people I've talked to that are really interested in different styles of music, different instruments, making instruments. It's a pretty small subgroup of musicians, I would say.
It is, yeah, it is. I think that's true. But we're not special or anything. We're just got our love. And you and the people who are more specialized, they have their love.
Yeah. You know? So.
And I've often envied, like, I don't know if you know, do you know Carla Kilstead, the violinist?
Nope.
Tin Hat? Oh, she's great. Oh, I think you'd like her. She's in a group called Tin Hat, mm-hmm. or Tin Hat Trio. But I when we were young, because we kind of grew up together, I mean, as adults, we met when she was like, I was 22, she was like 19, something like this. But I was often envious because she had lessons basically her whole life. Mm-hmm. And on violin, I was like, oh, I wish I had, yeah. But as I grew older, it's like, oh man, get over that shit. We all have our, everyone has their gift. And I have really great mentors, you know, really in the classical world, very famous people who took me under their wing because I'm not from the same cloth. You know, that's what attracted them to me. They're like, hey man, I want to work with you. And I'm like, how much do you charge? And he's, I don't, like, the old director of the symphony chorus, Vance George, mm-hmm. he took me, because I went to Westminster Choir College. So I keep my studies going, like, in the summers and stuff. And he took me under his wing, and I was like, I was curious. I was like, what's that about? And he goes, you're unlike any musician I met, and you're so passionate. I want to help you. And I said, well, how much are lessons? And he goes, I'm not going to charge you a dime. We would meet sometimes 3-4 days a week. For hours, and he never charged me a dime. That's why a lot of my students that come on scholarship, even though they're not underwritten, and I don't have anyone, you know, paying for them, but I do it because that's what was done for me.
So Vance George, what did you learn from him mostly?
Oh God, diction. You know, setting text. I mean, as a choral composer, I worked with a lot of composers, but Vance, he sees the text and he goes, oh no, you need to move this over. This is all falling on the wrong beat. He knows from directing so much choral music for centuries, for decades. You know, he had a stroke, so it's not the same. He did direct a bunch of us, though, at his, we had got a bunch of singers from the symphony, and he directed us. Oh, so beautiful. He's my adopted father. I mean, I have my father, who I love very, very much, and I just have two dads. You know, and he always wanted kids, and he never had them, you know. So I was kind of that. I still am for him, although we don't see each other as much. But that was the main thing of setting text, really studying the text. And also that comes from Alice Parker. Are you familiar with her? Oh, she was Robert Shaw's arranger. Okay. And, she just passed away. But, oh, man, such an important woman in the history of American music. Oh, my God. I got to spend a week with her. Not a whole week, but I won this thing. Blah, blah, blah. I'm going to leave that alone. A lot of what he's taught me, I know, came down from her. He just did conducting, mm-hmm. just being at ease. He had me doing lots of exercises, you know, but almost all of it was about being at ease, which is already, I'm aware of, but I'm a spaz. You know what I mean? I get really excited and I can get wound up when I don't need to be. Mm-hmm. And it's part of the bipolar thing, but just helping me stay calm, how to read a room. But the main thing, seriously, diction. How to sing well with diction, how to use language. She taught me all the IPA stuff. I mean, I knew some of that in advance, but man, that was so helpful. Mm-hmm. But he's a great composer, even though he's not a great composer. Like, if you were just to hand him something, he probably wouldn't even touch it. But to help me refine my work, oh my God. Okay. He had the very powerful outside eye.
And
things that composers didn't touch on. composers didn't even mention.
And I had Michael Calkin as one of your mentors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's it's interesting. We have, he was my assistant director with the choir, but he was my composition teacher. But I also work with, we have this, we're like co-mentors, okay. I would say. I think that's fair. Michael Calkin, I hope you concur with that. I think he would agree. Because I help him, I think the thing I've brought to him is helping him, like, abandon a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Not worry about it being right, you know what I mean? That's a lot, most of my classical friends, I'm like, that's one thing with all my students. When you make a mistake, you name it and you laugh at it. Don't beat ourselves, you know what I mean? You know how it is. Mm-hmm. I know you've been in different worlds. And jazz and classical, there's something, it's very, they're virtuosic forms. And making mistakes can be associated with being a less of a person. And No, if you're not making mistakes, you're not challenging yourself. You know, it's okay, make mistakes and laugh at them. How else are you going to get good at it, you know?
Yeah.
Anyhow, so I think I brought him some of that, but he's taught me a ton. Oh, my God. He went through, we went through the Fuchs together. He's been a huge help in my life. Mm-hmm. And a dear friend. I mean, I love that guy. I don't really work with people I don't love, truly. I mean, I love most everyone, for one. But that's one thing one of my other mentor, Lauren Pickford, said. Success in music is making music with people you love. And he is right. He is right. That's what success is. I think so. I mean, yeah. It's a very broad and very probably oversimplistic. But at the same time, there's something really valuable in there, I think.
I'm curious, Mark, you mentioned a couple times that you're neurodivergent, which can mean different mm-hmm. things. It could be attention or more like autism spectrum. What do you think those neurological differences give you, like in terms of the differences helping you?
Helping me? Well, it's definitely a give and take. I mean, I'm the kind of person who will, if I'm working, my ex-wife, if you could call her, would tell you, once I start working on a piece, I usually won't put it down until it's, like, I will do the entire orchestration of the full orchestral work in, like, 3 days, like, which is usually weeks and weeks of work. I can't stop. Mm. Well, I can. Now I know how to. But then I didn't.
Yeah.
I would get going, and I was up. I wouldn't have any drugs. I would just be up for 3 nights, and I start getting these tests. I get more and more madman. You know, and I do. Just like, I mean, that's how they depict Mozart, too. And, you know, it's thought posthumously that he and Beethoven both had bipolar type 2, you know. And there's a really famous book called Touched by Fire, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. And, or Touched with Fire. And it's about the artist, subtitle, the artist bipolar and manic depression on the artistic temperament. Something like that, or bipolar in the artistic temperament. And so people who have what I have tend to be poets and composers, and I'm both. And, you know, there's certain things that we're attracted to, while bipolar type 1, a.k.a. manic depression, because that's, you know, they realize not everyone gets full mania. That's when they came up with the term bipolar, and then bipolar type 2, and then cyclothymia is the other one. But they tend to be, like, people, their artistry in that realm tends to be prose writers and comedians, and it's a different animal. Mm. Like, we tend to be really attracted to stimulants, like Lord Byron was doing a bunch of cocaine, you know, and that's really common for people with bipolar type 2, while people with bipolar type 1 tend to be more attracted to alcohol and opiates, right? And that, you can see it all through time. You know, Hemingway was obviously a big alcoholic, but classically manic depressive. And so we got these two, you know, and those are that. What I'm telling you is, at the time, based on a survey of over 50 studies done in Europe. So it's not just like, you know, this is real information here, you know, scientific. That's the thing, though. That book came out like 20 years ago, so I don't know where it is now, right? But okay, for me, I get excited, and I'm really good at the impetus. Sometimes I have a hard time finishing things, though, because I have so many projects going. Mm-hmm. Like, one of them is going to fall aside, you know? Downsides, there are times where I would have weeks where I couldn't even move because I was so depressed. You know my trick for that, though? I keep, you know, those little squeezy, like, applesauce packets mm-hmm. for kids, like toddlers? that you just squeeze, I keep them under my bed. And if I'm depressed, I go, oh yeah, I reach down and I grab one. And it just increases my getting back on my feet and cooking and going for a walk. Speed it up by weeks. Seriously. It used to be really bad. I wouldn't eat for days. I wouldn't do anything. I barely even have water. Man, and going to the bathroom was such a headache. You know, because I'm so, I just was listless. But that was often after a period, almost always after a period of hypomania where I was working on a piece for 3 days straight. You know, so I've learned how my trick now is, now, and I also, I don't have an official ADHD diagnosis, but I know lots and lots of doctors and lots of, you know, like really good psychiatrists who are like, oh, dude, the second I met you, I knew you had ADHD. Come on. And they're like, child, please, you know, of course you have ADHD. So, but I haven't pursued it, you know, an actual diagnosis. But I think one of the main tricks for me now is if I am composing, I'll call a friend like Miles or Frank or whoever and say, hey, I'm composing. Call me at 11 p.m. and you watch me put a sleeping pill in my mouth, under my tongue, and swallow it. Or else I'm not going to bed. And they do it. I've burned some bridges. I mean, it's inevitable. People with this kind of, neurodivergence or mental, I'm like calling it a mental illness because it's a blessing. You know what I mean? If I was raised in Papua New Guinea, I'd be a shaman. Anyone who has what I have is ready to be a shaman. You know what I mean? We just don't have support here. We don't know. I mean, for a million reasons, but the stigma against this stuff is so strong.
Yeah.
But I'm very much a community advocate. But yeah, having those little things like the friends. Oh, I was saying, it's inevitable. You lose people. That's one of the worst things about, you know, bipolar type 2, where it manifests the most, and from every article I've read, we get really, our psyches get turned on and turned up for an event, but then we end up self-sabotaging. And it's the things we love the most that we self-sabotage. So we keep losing the things we love the most over and over again. It's really hard. I'll tell you right now, there was a time when I could not go to the finale on my own choir. Mm. I'd worked months. I booked all that material. I memorized all that material. I taught all that material. And I couldn't go. I was frozen.
To conduct? Someone else had to do it?
To conduct, oh. Yeah. And with no warning. I know. That's the downside. Mm-hmm. That's why I've been creating a life where I don't have to necessarily be there at that time as much. It's an accommodation for myself, you know?
Yeah.
But the thing is, in people who don't understand will make all these assumptions or think that you're an asshole, when really, no, I was so depressed, I couldn't move. Literally, I didn't even have the strength to stand up if I wanted to, you know? And it gets that way. Mm-hmm. It's hard. People living with different conditions like schizophrenia. I tell people, like I was next to a gay couple, and I'm guessing they're gay because they're holding hands in the Castro, walking down. They turned and looked at this guy who I knew from the neighborhood who has schizophrenia, who suffers really bad and is not getting the care he needs. They go, they ought to lock him up. And I turned and said, you know, they used to say that about you too. And they're like, oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my. They were like, oh my, thank you. They hadn't thought about that. But the stigma against people with mental health conditions, the way we talk about them on the street as crazies and all this stuff. Oh my God, look at Nextdoor or Facebook. It is devastating the way people talk about people who are suffering from mental health conditions. These people came by it naturally. They inherited this. And they're like people with schizophrenia, they're going through the whole day listening to people berate them. Can you imagine that? It's real to them. That doesn't make them less of a human being. They need more care. We have a long way to go with racism, a long way to go. But we've been talking about it for a long time. We have a long way to go with sexism. Sexism in our world, the belief that men are superior to women, absolute BS. And the only way that men can substantiate is by trying to put women down. And it's ugly, and we've seen it. It's done. But and we're not done. But we have talked about it for a long time. People with mental health conditions, this is a brand new conversation.
Yeah.
We're just fighting for people's rights now, man. But I stand up for people who are suffering. They aren't meant to be locked up. They are meant to be cared for. And the same with the drug substance abuse. These are not people who are just trying to flake off. They are hooked on hard drugs because they went through a probably really hard time, or people on the streets. Of course they're on drugs, man. Are you, try living on the streets. You go, I mean, not you, you personally, but anyone, go try it for a week and see how it feels. And that's why all those young women are on meth, because it makes them feel strong. Seriously. I have but at the same time, I have empathy for them. I also have empathy for the people who are not very educated and think that they should be locked up. I understand that that's where you're coming from, and I'm not going to fault you for it. And let's look at it, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you can tell I'm passionate. See, that's one upside, is I am passionate. And when I'm on stage, if I'm not there, if I'm there and someone says, hey, play a song for us, and the audience isn't there for me, oh, that's hard for me. But if I know the audience is there for me, oh, I let it rip. I bring it everything I have, you know, because that's, they're there for it. So I'm going to give it everything I have, you know, and it's hard for me to do things half-assed.
So look, thanks so much for sharing, you know, this these depths of perceptions and really showing the world like how beautiful music can be in so many different ways. And
oh gosh, I hope that comes through, because music is, and when you know what, it's all of ours. There's not a single one of you that can't play music. You can play music. It is in you. It is your birthright. It is your birthright as a human being. And just because you had a shitty teacher because your family told you weren't a good singer doesn't mean anything except for what they said. It doesn't, it's just their words.
Okay, well, thanks.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. Or you can browse the collection of merch with a very cool, unique, and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly, with notebooks, mugs, shirts, phone cases, and more. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. Have a wonderful week.